Interesting. Let's get our Bibles open again to Romans 8:31. In our last lesson, we ended up by approaching, I took the bulk of our last lesson talking about the serious nature in which our Father is going to now begin probing our heart and asking us, asking us those five probing questions and how they're structured and what He's going after as He probes into our heart. And now as we come to Romans 8:31, and the first question regulates and sets up all the rest of the questions. So the last thing I did at the end of our last lesson was to keep in mind the context is sonship, the point perspective is our Father when He put this whole curriculum together and when He designed it and how He designed it, and the regulator that makes everything that's said from the remainder of verse 31 to the end of the chapter, what shall we then say to these things? You've allowed that chain of provision to effectually work to produce confidence that you know that all things work together for good because of those reasons. He foreknew me, He predestinated me, He called me, He justified me, He glorified me. Now the Father says, Son, there's things you don't know about that are going to be problematic to you. I'm going to begin asking you a series of questions that's going to probe deep into your heart, do that open heart surgery, and each one is going after potential snags, potential issues that you may have not one clue as. They're lying latent in your heart. But because I know down the road you're going to experience things that's going to draw those problems to the surface, let's get them out of the way now so the curriculum has free course through your heart and there's no restrictions in there that could cause you blockages being straightened in your bowels, so to speak, so that this whole thing has free course and functions within you the way it's designed to function. And so that's the critical nature of what you're going through, so that the resistance, the inadequate comprehension, the weak comprehension is brought to your mind. It's answered. And again, you don't just go along and answer the five questions, no one, he shall, nobody, no one, no one. But that they're answered by being handled properly. The right answer isn't just all we're after. It's the proper handling of these five probing questions. And God our Father, in view of that first opening question, what shall we then say to these things? Our Father is now, I say this guardingly, but it's the only word I could really come up with, He's now forcing us to make some comments and to give an answer based upon what verses 28, 29, and 30 said about being able to succeed with our sonship lives on the basis of the curriculum He's provided for us to operate on. He's actually engaged. What shall we then say to these things? I know Paul wrote this, but this is our Father coming along saying, now you and I need to start talking about this, and I'm going to ask you some questions. That, as I said before, if you had the 3x5 card, you could hold it there all day long and you're never going to come up with this. We put the 3x5 card away for now. We'll bring it back out when we hit verse 38. But right now, these are things you never would have come up with on your own. And you may think that you've got full confidence in verse 28 and full assurance that this is geared for your success. But what about when I uncover something in your heart and say, hey, there's something laying there. If this was touched upon, you may have a problem with this. You may be willing to quit on it. You may be hung up on a particular issue and not willing to trust me fully. And that's what He's after. And I'm going to, as a father knowing this whole thing, I'm going to uncover those things that potentially would cause you to distrust me and to not trust fully what I wrote when you read it to do its effectual job within you. So He's forcing you to begin to make a comment, to give comments, to give answers based upon what has been said within the framework of handling this properly. And what He's doing by asking the following probing questions, there's five that follow this first one, He knows exactly what He's going after. with each one of them. And at the exact same time, when he does it, when he asks us, if I am for you, if God be for us, there's the first one that he asks, if God be for us, who can be against us? It's not just coming along and flippantly saying, well, nobody. It's going after something, and the Father knows what he's going after. And at the exact same time, when he does it, by uncovering it, by exposing it, and drawing it out so that we deal with it, even if it's not a problem with us, by getting it on the table, so to speak, and in front of our eyes, he's intelligizing us. If nothing else, if you come across and you say, okay, I've had, when you get through all five of these and you say, well, three of the five I really had trouble with, the other two not so much. And for you it may be different. Maybe all five. Maybe two of the five. Or maybe they all had various levels of problems with you. But the fact is, problem or not, there's still things that wouldn't naturally come to your thinking unless the Father brings it up, brings the question to your mind, as he probes deeply into your heart about it. What comes out of that is he's intelligizing us with knowledge of what he's going after. Problem or not, this is what needs to be gone after. So that we can intelligent, and in fact, oftentimes in surgery, when you do probing, you may find everything's healthy there. But the fact of the matter is, now I know, as the surgeon looking, and when you come out of the anesthetic, I'll tell you, and you'll know that everything's good. Or if it's not, I'll know it, and you'll know it. And this is one of those areas where the Father's going after something, and at the exact same time, he's intelligizing us so we can intelligently work together with him. And unlike what goes on in that illustration about the operating table and going under the knife and having open heart surgery, when you're in that situation, you're unconscious. There's only one surgery I know of in which you are purposely conscious in that surgery. That's brain surgery, of all things. They keep you awake in brain surgery, and they talk to you during the whole thing. They got your head popped, you know, the top of your head popped off there, and they got your brain uncovered, and they're looking at your brain. They got this, there's somebody sitting there, and they'll hold pictures up. There's a long time of doing this. I saw it done on when they used to have the medical channel, or whatever it used to be called. If Andrew saw this, he'd faint. But they took a probe, and they'd touch this part of your brain, and they'd hold a card up, and they'd ask you to identify it. Cow, okay, do it again. Sheep, okay, do it again. I can't see it, I'm blind. Okay, then they'd take, they'd take a sticker. They had a whole set of stickers. And they'd take a sticker with a number on it, and they'd stick it where the probe went. And he knows, don't probe there, or I'll blind this guy. And then he'd probe a little bit more, and he'd say, what is this? And it's a picture of a flower, and you go, and you can't talk. He'd put a sticker there. Don't probe there, or he's not going to be able to talk. And they'd do that and map your whole brain out. Now, what I'm after is that in the kind of open-heart surgery where this whole analogy kind of breaks down, you're there on the table unconscious because you've been put under anesthesia. But in this heart surgery your Father's doing for you, when he says, what shall we say, what shall we then say to these things? You're supposed to be wide awake in this case. And he expects us to intelligently feel the knife of his scalpel, of his word, so to speak, operating within our heart. And cutting in there, and exposing, and examining. We're supposed to, in fact, before we get to the end of this, you're going to feel things deeply. Before we get out of this, you're going to feel almost like you've been through a whole wash cycle. Because you're not only going to be dealing with your intelligence and being intelligized, but there are some of these questions that are asked to purposely cause you to emote. And this is an amazing thing that he does, but it's designed to do something about your soul and your spirit, and it's designed to get some emotion going. And there's a reason for that. And we'll get to all of that in time. But for now, what I'm after is to again, just to cap off our understanding of how these questions work and what he's doing. He expects us to feel what he's doing and feel him making the incisions that need to be made in order to get to the things he's going after. We're to be awake during that. We're to be conversing with him and commenting and giving answers. And all during the operation, he expects us to come along and say some things back to him. What shall we then say to these things? Say back to him. For us to come along and say, okay, I see this now. Boy, this, I hadn't even thought these thoughts before. I never thought that these thoughts about me. And I certainly, when they're brought out and dealt with, I never thought about your word this way. I never knew your word could do that. Has it ever occurred to you in all the years you've been a Christian that there may be things about God's word? I don't mean knowledge-wise. I don't mean about being able to know who Saul's second cousin twice removed was. I'm not talking about Bible trivia. But I mean ability-wise and capacity-wise, that after all these years, you really haven't even scratched the surface as to what God's word can do, what it has the ability to do. And the truth is, there's only two people in the universe, two people on this earth who could possibly know that. One is an intelligized son. The other is Satan, the adversary himself. He knows what it can do. So you get an idea on why this probe has to take place. But you're to be able to come along and say things like, well, now I can see some things that I hadn't seen before. I see this now, or something along those lines. In other words, you have an intelligent response. You don't just come along and say, well, the first question, no one. The second question, he shout. The next question, nobody. The fourth question, no one. Then no one. And I'm done. There, I took my test. This isn't a test. This is an examination. It's like, don't you hate it? The other day, we've had a guy that's been calling us at night. And we get, because on our TV screen now the number comes up. And you see this guy, I finally had enough of it. I knew it was some salesman or something, so I answered it. And sure enough, this guy had been trying to get a hold of us, and he was doing a survey. You ever answer a survey on the phone? Probably not. I shouldn't have, but I had a few minutes, and I thought it might be entertaining. Nothing much was on TV, so I said, okay, let's have a go at it. Well, it was a survey about our phone book and which one we use, and blah, blah, blah. And he wanted the number off it and everything else. It took about 5 or 10 minutes and all those kinds of things. But it dawned on me as I was going through this survey, I was trying to answer questions right. You ever take a survey and... My mother did this once. She's like the Republican Party called her and asked her a bunch of questions. She worried that she didn't answer the questions right. It's a survey. You can't answer the questions wrong. It's a survey. All right? Well, this isn't just coming along desiring answers, getting an answer. This isn't just a survey, and it's not coming along just saying, as long as you say the right answer, I don't care what happens. That's public school. Okay? Public school says, just put the right answer down. That way I'll look like I taught you something. Because all the people do is just look at the numbers, look at the percentages, blah, blah, blah. They don't really care anything about education. That's not this. Our Father cares deeply about it, and so therefore, He's not just after a right answer, He's after what that answer has intelligized you to intelligently, I know I'm overdoing that and being redundant, but I'm to intelligently be able to respond to it by not just giving the right answer, but giving it on the basis of its effectual work in my heart. And to do that, I have to be able to do it to say to those things, if God be for me, who could be against me? And so forth and so on. And having that intelligent response, that's one, first of all, that's an awareness on your part that, yeah, even if this isn't, this could be a real problem. I actually do have a problem in that area. And to therefore, on the basis of what verses 28, 29, and 30 have said, think about that potential problem in view of that, take what the answer is as the remedy to the problem, and then get rid of it, dismiss it, and replace it with absolute confidence, assurance, conviction, godly confidence. Because you've come to realize, hey, that's not a problem at all. In view of, which is why that verse, that first question is so important, in view of that information that's sitting in verses 28 through 30 and what it said, this isn't a problem. But without that, it would be. Without knowing my Father did foreknow me, predestinate me, call me, justify me, glorify me, it could be a problem and would be. So when we think about then now succeeding with our sonship lives, which is what this whole third component of our sonship establishment is all about, everything that's being said here is to get it so that we not only in theory and theoretically realize that our Father has geared us for success, but that becomes a living reality. We're fully convinced that we can succeed if we'll just implicitly trust and rely and operate upon what the curriculum says. But since the overall issue, once again, is convincing us that we can succeed and will succeed if we operate upon it, the curriculum, like we're supposed to, then what that does is that starts a bend in your thinking. Your mind is bent towards something, and the natural bend of your mind before you begin the curriculum is to make sure that, listen carefully, all known sources of problems have been accounted for by the curriculum. In other words, before I actually begin sitting down, cracking a book open there in Romans 12, and start my phase 2 of level 1 sonship training, where I start receiving instruction. That's where I start receiving instruction in godly wisdom, justice, judgment, equity. Before that ever begins, the natural bend of my mind in sonship establishment is to make sure that all known sources, all of them, all the known sources of problems, all right, they've all been accounted for by the curriculum. That's the kind of trust your Father wants you to have. In these 5 probing questions, that virtually is what is going to take place. It's going to bring up the known sources. I'm not saying it's going to come up and categorically analyze, list A, B, C, D, E, F, G, every single problem you could ever have. But what it does do, in more than just a general way, it actually exposes all of the known sources. When you look at a river, I like rivers. I spent a lot of time at the Wabash River in Indiana. I asked a lady the other night who was playing if she could play on the banks of the Wabash. She had no idea what the song was. I felt badly because she was really old. No, I didn't feel bad for her. I felt bad for me. I stumped an old person. What's going on? We crossed the Ohio River when we were going up to Evansville. And by the way, that place looked like it had been in war. I had never... You know, we went through the ice storm here a few years ago. They went through one of the worst ice storms in history there. I mean, whole trees have just been ripped to shreds. It looks like a picture of the Civil War. If you've ever seen what happened to the trees at the Battle of Gettysburg, that's what it looked like going up there. It was unbelievable, the devastation of that ice. But the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, you stand at any place along the way, you're seeing the river, but you're not seeing its source. We may be able to come along and say, well, Romans 8, 31 through 39 doesn't address every single problem I'll ever have. No, it addresses every source of every problem. And there are 5 of them. It's going after every and all known sources of the problem. If you can cut it off and kill it at its source, then the problems that occur from it won't even happen. They're systematic. That's not right. They're what am I after? They're symptomatic. I knew something was wrong there, but they're symptomatic. This goes at the source. The Father has the wisdom to be able to shortcut this and make it far more simple by just going to the source of all known problems. And the curriculum, that's what you get intelligized with. This curriculum accounts for all known sources of problems and snags and hindrances that I may have. They've all been accounted for by the curriculum. They can be addressed, and they are addressed by the curriculum. And they can be overcome by that curriculum. Which is why he ends up with that. The loudest statement of this whole section is in verse 37. Verses 38 and 39 are very quiet. They're the quiet after the storm. But the crescendo ends in verse 38. Nay, in all of these things, we're more than conquerors through him that loved us. They can be overcome by this curriculum. So that's what's going on here. And in order to address all those known sources of problems in your heart, it takes five things that have to be brought up to your attention that on your own you wouldn't even think about. And it takes beginning, listen carefully, with a general issue. If God be for us, who can be against us? If you have perceived, that's a very general statement. You're right. It is. And it's that way by design. And as I have said before, don't be shy about embracing generalities. I'm not at all, because they're the easiest for me to understand. It's the particulars that cause me trouble. But those general, broad things still are very profound and very important, because they lay the bedrock foundation for everything else that can be built and stand upon it. They provide you the strength for the structure to stand. So this begins with a general issue, and as you go through the five, they go on to more and more specific issues until all of those sources of problems get probed in your heart, and any and all snags in your thinking are brought up to the surface and brought out and dealt with and dismissed. But they're dismissed, again, in light of what verse 28, 29, and 30 have said. In light of what's sitting in those three verses. And the result being, once they're brought out, seen to be cared for, and dealt with, and overcome by the curriculum, by our Father's chain of provision of that curriculum, of what he's done to foreknow us, predestinate us, call us, justify us, and glorify us, the result is those problems are never to be a problem ever again. Because you can trust his word implicitly to do its job. Now you have to maybe go home today or between now and Wednesday and look at these again. And when you look at the five together, and I've tried to put them up here, even though I know it's small, but I've tried to put them up there with everything that goes along with them. When you look at the five, and they're easy to look at, they're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and the fifth one takes the last three verses, all of 35, 36, and 37, that's all in the fifth one. But when you look at those five, you have to take time and see if you really perceive that that's exactly what happens as you go down through these five probing questions. What I'm after there is that you do see, you go from the general to the more specific, and even the more specific, they're actually in an order. And the first one is the most general one of all. That first one, once again, if I can find the right thing here, well, that's where I am, and that's where I want to be. The first question, if God be for us, who can be against us, is the most general one. And you go from that general, who can be against us, to when you read down to the who, the last three questions all begin with the word who, what I call the who questions. You go from that general, who can be against me, just who in general, you go to a, you know, I can put my finger on some specific characters and individuals that can cause me some real problems. Which is why that shift takes place between the second and third question. After the first two questions, the last three who questions, you do see there's a shift there. And verses 33, 34, and 35 deal with those more advanced questions or more specific questions. Well, I say just all that just to once again underscore the fact that you're going from the general to the more specific and more particular issues. So if all that makes sense, and if we've carefully made it so that we're not just getting right answers, but that we're handling these right to get to the heart of the matter, let's begin with that first question. And we'll see how far we can get this morning. Probably not very far, but we can at least introduce it. If God be for us, who can be against us? What's the answer to that? No one. Class dismissed. Let's go home. No. Again, let's think about this question for a moment. In fact, if I can just get this done today, this will be enough. And we're not going to, you know, have to sit and meditate by humming something to try to get to the root of all of this. If God be for us, who can be against us? How many times I've heard in the middle of someone's preaching, and they're trying to get you to the mission field, or they're trying to get you to do this, or they're trying to get you to do great things for God, or they got their pom-poms out, and they're rah, rah, rahing for Jesus. And right in the middle of all of that, when they're going after the devil, and we're gonna chase that devil out of town, and all of these kinds of things. In the middle of that, they'll say, after all, if God be for us, who can be against us? It almost sounds like a cheer. God, He's our man. If He can't do it, no one can. If God is for us, who could be against us? Go, God, push him back, wave, push that devil back. You know, all these kinds of, man, I could, if I was in certain churches, I could have people just going crazy. And then don't wait, don't stop there, friend, don't stop there. Get the deacons and pass the plate. I don't want to hear any clanking in there either. I want that long green. I know how to get that done. I know churches where they'll take up the collection, they'll count it, and if it wasn't enough, they'll pass it again. My pastor went to a church down in Florida like that. I said, how many times did they pass the plate? He said, 4 times in one service. Until they got the right amount. And it kind of does sound that, have that tone. If God be for us, who can be against us? But again, the common mistake most folks make who teach this, the pastors who teach it, who write the brilliant geniuses who seem like that they have the in with God and just can't stand not writing a commentary about this verse. The common mistake is to answer that question by reason and logic. And logically, that's the only logical answer that question can be answered with. They just, by pure, well, they say, if God is God, and usually that's worth 10, 20 minutes of sermon right there, God is God. And then they launch into His omnipotence and His power and His omnipresence and His omnipotence and omniscience and all His sovereignty and all. If God is God. And then they have personal illustrations that they've had experiences with it. Where my kids spilt the milkshake in the back seat of the car and I had to pull over right away to clean up the mess. And if I hadn't have, I would have gone right across that railroad tracks and been smacked by a train. If God's for me, see, He's for me. Not even that old train could be against me. Oh, hallelujah. Praise Jesus. Here's my wallet. That's what all that preaching is after, by the way. It's all after money. But the logic is, if God's God and He's all-powerful, all-knowing and sovereign, well then, if He's for you, then nobody can possibly be against you. Nobody can withstand Him. Nobody can withstand His omnipotence. Nobody can withstand His power to just stomp out any attempt by anybody or anything to ever come against you. In fact, I want to show you something that is a common the common thinking along this line, even if this passage isn't commonly referred to, this is the common thinking. Come back all the way back with me in your Bible to 2 Chronicles. This ought to, I ought to hear some. haven't separated the gold leaf on that book yet in my Bible. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Like I said, this may not be the passage that they will take you to, but this is what is appealed to in how to answer, if God be for us, who can be against us? Now, to break into the context here, we're back in Israel's program, of course, in time past, but we're at a time in which the nation is now under the courses of punishment. And as they approach the first course of punishment and then go into the second course of punishment, what was told would happen to them if they ever merited the courses of punishment by stupidly going under that law, one of the things that was going to happen is God was going to divide their power. And that's exactly what happened. You have David who comes to the throne, reigns. He then is able to turn that over to his son Solomon. Once Solomon's reign is ended, the nation of Israel becomes divided. And when they do, you have two different segments of Israel. You have Judah, and you have Israel itself. Judah is comprised of two tribes, Israel's comprised of 10, and you have the divided kingdom, they're split. And then you have a series of succession of kings that are, some of them outright evil to the core, some of them are good to various degrees, but all of them are failures. Because no one is going to be able to succeed in reigning as king of Israel from the time of Solomon's throne, actually from the time of David's, until Jesus Christ sits on that throne. And they were involved in all sorts of mischief and just sin and all kinds of things. They were a mess through this time. Well, if you come down on Judah's side here, you come down and one of the big guys that's down there about, one quarter of the way down is a fellow by the name of Jehoshaphat. This is him right here. And if you track across this little chart here, you find out he was king of Judah during the reign of a king that you probably have been aware of, not too nice of a guy by the name of Ahab, who was the king of the Israel portion of the division. So that kind of gives you a frame of reference a little bit as to what's going on here. And in 2 Chronicles, it's Jehoshaphat who is doing the talking and the center of attention right now. So Israel was in a mess. And all mostly of their own doing. But you get glimpses in some of these kings, and Jehoshaphat's an example of one who tries to do things right, but somehow along the line he always seemed to screw up here and there, and enough anyway to where he just, had real problems. But this section is what I'm after when it comes to most Christians' idea of what it means for God to be for me, who can be against me. Let's pick it up at verse 1. This is 2 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 1. It came to pass after this also that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and we could spend a lot of time on this, but I'm not going to do it, but those are two nations that when God talked to Israel about going in and destroying these people and what he was going to do to the Canaanites and what he was going to do with the enemies of Israel, there are two peoples that God has reserved to himself. And this goes back to the way the adversary used them in the beginning of God's conquest and God's repossession of the earth back and reconciling it back unto himself. And it's almost like he takes Moab and Ammon and he says, no, they're mine. I'm going to deal with them personally. So it came to pass also that that the children, after this also, that the children of Moab and the children of Ammon, and with them other beside the Ammonites, came against Jehoshaphat to battle. Now these guys are going to, they're trying to make war against Judah. Then there came, and that's really all you need to know right now about the scene or the context of what's going on here. Then there came some saying that told Jehoshaphat, saying, I need my glasses. This is what they said. There cometh a great multitude against thee from beyond the sea on this side Syria. And behold, they which be in Hazazon, Tamar, which is in Gedi. And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah gathered themselves together to ask help of the Lord. And again, that's capital L, capital O, capital R, capital L, that's Jehovah. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Lord. And Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah in Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court and said, O Lord God of our fathers, art not thou God in heaven? What's he doing? You're God. And rulest not thou over all the kingdoms of the heathen? And in thine hand is there not power and might so that none is able to withstand thee? Doesn't this sound like it's making a case for if God be for us, who can be against us? Art thou not our God who didst drive out the inhabitants of this land before thy people Israel and gavest it to the seed of Abraham, to thy friend forever? He's reminding God of his own covenant. I find that interesting. And they dwelt therein and have built thee a sanctuary therein for thy name, saying, if when evil cometh upon us as a sword, judgment or pestilence or famine, we stand before this house and in thy presence, for thy name is in this house, and cry unto thee in our affliction, then thou wilt hear and help. And now behold, the children of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom thou wouldest not let Israel invade. See, God wouldn't let them go in there. He's kept them for himself. When they came out of the land of Egypt, but they turned from them and destroyed them not, behold, I say, how they reward us to come to cast us out of thy possession. They're going to throw us out of the land which thou hast given us to inherit. O our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us, neither know we what to do. I'm coming back to that because that's critical. But our eyes are upon thee. And this is where the congregation would start humming, turn your eyes upon you, when the pastor's going here. And all Judah stood before the Lord with their little, oh, bring the children into it. That's got to get God going there. Look at these little kids. They brought their children, the little ones, their wives, and their children. Then upon Jahaziel, the son of Zechariah, the son of Benaiah, the son of Jeiel, the son of Mattaniah, a Levite of the sons of Asaph, came the Spirit of the Lord in the midst of the congregation. And he said, hearken ye all Judah and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, and thou King Jehoshaphat, thus saith the Lord unto you, be not afraid nor dismayed. Come on, chin up, have some confidence. By reason of this great multitude, for the battle is not yours, but God's. Almost reminiscent of David when he said, the battle is the Lord's. By the way, well, I'm not going to say that. Tomorrow go ye down against them. Behold, they come up by the cliff of Ziz, and ye shall find them at the end of the brook before the wilderness. He's given them a sit rep on what they're going to do. He's given them inside information. The wilderness of Jeruel. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Set yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord with you. O Judah and Jerusalem, fear not, nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Lord will be with you. Let's stop there. Heavens, what a great scenario of the godness of God. And these little ruffians come up here, these Somali pirates. these Moab, these Ammonites and Moabites, and they're coming up there and they're laying in conspiracy to attack Israel and all this kind of thing. God being God and they being not God, he's going to come up and he's going to fight. Oh yes, hallelujah, praise Jesus. If God be for us, who can be against us? All right. Now let's just simmer down and think about that thing for a moment, and you're going to see some things. Either this very story, or and I don't mean this as a way of it just being a story, but this very account, biblical account, is used itself to underscore, if God be for us, who can be against us? Or else the concepts of it are brought over and applied, if God be for us, who can be against us? And to be quite honest with you, in the few remaining tidbits of commentaries I've got, that I've got left, the issue of if God be for us, who can be against us, usually those commentaries have one sentence to give to that, and that's it. And what that tells you, when a commentator has about that much to say about something, usually it means they have that much understanding of it. Now, we don't have time to go into all of this. I wish I did, because this would be a lot of fun. It's just great fun for me to do this. But let's just look at a couple of things and show you how inconsistent this is with anything that's being said in Romans 8:31. If God be for us, who can be against us? A couple of things should have just leaped off the page. And as you go, if you read through this carefully, you'd find a half a dozen or more that just pop in your thinking and make you realize this, no way is this talking about us. Not only do we know that because we're obviously back here in Israel's program. We're back here in the Chronicle accounts. We're back here during the time of Israel in their second course of punishment. All of this kind of thing. You can see that clearly there. But what I'm after is to see the things that leap off the page and say, that's not sonship. One of them is in verse 12. When he cries, "Oh, our God, wilt thou not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that cometh against us." First of all, that's inconsistent with sonship. Because you're supposed to have the might and the power resident within you. Do you see how they're always after the, almost like the third party in this? There's the enemy, there's us, and there's God, and God has to do it because we can't. Why is that inconsistent with sonship? God has to do it because we can't. We're adults. The whole point of sonship is for you to do it and not him. To you emulate his thinking and living and labor. And the worst thing, the most glaring thing of all that I see here is what is said in the very next phrase, "Neither know we what to do." I don't know what to do. Well, notice God does this for them, but he's doing it for them as children. He's not coming along and doing this. That's abhorrent to a father to hear out of his son who's been properly educated and intelligized. That's what I mean by being intelligized. You know what to do. You know to prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. You don't need God to come down here and do this for you. And it's not because I don't want him to. Well, in a sense it is. But it's because I can do this. His word has so affected me and effectually worked in me that I know what to do and I know how to do it. That's one of them that just glaringly tells me that is not at all what if God be for us, then who can be against us is about, because the context won't allow me to think that I don't know what to do, and then later on, this may be a little more sophisticated, but I was going to make comment on another verse. Let's come down to verse 17 because I can catch it in this verse. The last verse we read. Ye shall not need to fight in this battle. Is that sonship? No way. You're going to have to slug it out and fight. That's part of why Paul... That's why Paul will go and look at the 10th chapter of 2 Corinthians sometimes and see him about warring this warfare, but it's all the inner man. Pulling down strongholds and every high thing that exalteth itself against God? No, against the knowledge of God. We're in a war of wisdom. And we're going to have to fight it. And it's going to affect us internally and it's going to affect us externally. But that's part of being an adult son. And not to worry because God is for me and who could possibly be against me. But not like this. Not where I have to come along and say there's three parties. There's one party, me. An intelligent son who knows what to do and knows how to do it and knows what the Word of God that works effectually within me can do. But even more we could squeeze out of verse 17. You shall not need to fight. Israel. Set yourself, stand still, see the salvation of the Lord with you, O Judah and Jerusalem. Fear not, nor be dismayed. Tomorrow go out against them, for the Lord will be with you. Up there earlier, it talked about the battle is not yours, but God's. Wrong. The battle is yours. As an adult son, you're going to have to be out there on your own. Now, I don't mean that God leaves you or any of those kinds of things. What I'm saying is an adult son does have to fight. He does have to get his hands dirty. He does have to be engaged with an adversary. In fact, he's going to have to be more engaged with the adversary's minions, his cohorts, and his henchmen. But you're going to be in a battle. And that's why Paul will tell Timothy, you war a good warfare. He doesn't come along and say, you make sure that you really, you know, be kind of earnest in this. No, he says it's war, and it is war. But this is what I'm after. Let's get tie this all up here. What I'm really after in this is that you see that this is the common way. If you think about the way you've ever heard anything about the issue of God being for us, who can be against us? And all I'm going to be able to do this morning is talk about what it's not. And on Wednesday we'll answer what it is and hopefully get on to the second probing question. But for now, the answer is usually given in light of that kind of background. If not that actual scenario, something similar to that, where God being God that He is, nobody could possibly attempt to come against Him. Nobody could come against you if He's for you, therefore. So the answer is no one. Well, even though that's the right answer, the problem with that is that this cannot be, and it's not supposed to be, answered on the basis of that. Not only on the basis of pure logic, but on the basis of how God operated in His time past program with Israel. Because they weren't sons. I mean, they weren't being educated as sons. They were children. They were under a law system of tutors and governors that forbade God to be able to educate them as their father. So, to get a little light on it, the context isn't one of coming along and putting it in that kind of framework. And so even though that's the right answer, no one, that's not the honest handling of the question, not by a long shot. And for two major reasons, and we'll end on this. First of all, the context isn't one of assessing God's competence. We're not coming along saying, if God be for us, well, let's think about this God for a moment, and let's assess His competence to be able to do things. He spoke the world into existence. Well, Christ actually did. He's God all powerful. He's God all knowing. He's God all everywhere. He's God all sovereign. He's God all authority. He can at a blink, he can annihilate the whole, he could blink the whole universe out of existence if he wanted. That's the kind of power he's got. But the context isn't one of doing that. It's not assessing God's competence to sovereignly do whatever he wants to do. What did we say in the first session? You've just split off from the pack, and there you go. You're out in the woods. Somebody send the context police after that poor lost person and get them back here out of the woods. That's the 10 how to deal with this, because nobody knows anything else. They're not following what's going on here. Especially if you just crack it over, you like to throw this out as a whip, you know, a snap at the end of your whip on a snappy line of phrases that you've said to really pop into people's thinking and give the Lord a hand clap in the house kind of crap. Well, that's a great one to get a hand clap for Jesus and all this kind of thing. But that's not what's going on here. We're not assessing God's competence and sovereignty and power to do whatever he wants to do. And in our case, to intervene, like he did with Jehoshaphat, by his omnipotent hand into the affairs and manipulate and massage the affairs and events and circumstances around me and just go stomping out any and all things that could ever oppose me. He just stomps on them. No, the context is sonship education in general. Sonship establishment specifically, it's a sonship issue. If God be for me, as a son, who could be against me as a son? And you can't take that question and answer it like any old logical person would, even if he's a believer, even if he's an unbeliever, even if he's an atheist. Like I said, if an atheist would just suspend his belief for a moment, and on the basis of pure logic, he could answer that question properly. He'd answer it, or at least answer, get the right answer from it, even though he doesn't believe any of it. You don't have to be a believer to answer that question right. This is about sonship and my success as my father's son. As I go through his sonship curriculum, as I operate upon the curriculum for my sonship life. And secondly, you have to allow that first question, the setup question, that one right there, the first question that sets up all the five probing questions, how they're supposed to be viewed, and allow that to dictate to you just exactly how each question, and this being the first one, is supposed to be responded to and answered on the basis of. What shall we then say to these things? It's not what shall we then say to 2 Chronicles. What shall we then say to Romans 8, 28, 29, and 30? In light of that, if God be for us, who can be against us? So, we have to answer this first probing question in view of our Father's point perspective, as laid out in those three verses, 28, 29, and 30, and from the context of our sonship life, those two things. Therefore, a logical, and I think sometimes even a flippant answer of no one just won't work, because it doesn't allow for that question to do its deep probing into our heart. And it is one that probes in there. And we'll see that next time. By the context in which it's asked in the first place, it probes. Without the context, it doesn't probe anything. But with the context, it probes deep into our heart, and therefore it just, if all you do is answer it flippantly or logically, no one, it just won't get at what our Father wants it to get at in our heart, if that's all we can come up with. The right answer, but for the wrong reason. So beginning next time, we're going to look at that question again, but this time by properly handling it. And between now and then, think about that question. And the key to that question is really the word for and the word against. It's not God so much. If he be for us, how is he being for us? In what way? Who could be against us? Against us doing what? You answer those questions, and you're going to start getting the probing in your heart. How is God for us? And how is someone going to be against us? I know it's general, but when you take the context, one, and two, the set-up question to put it in light of those three verses, you'll be able to answer how God is for me and how somebody could be against me. And allow that to roll over in your mind again and again and again. Because what's being assessed is my Father's words to me. It's the curriculum He's putting in my hand, the education He's going to give me. It's not God, an assessment of Him and His Godness. It's an assessment of Him as my Father and what He has written when He foreknew me, and how when He wrote it, it predestinated and fixed my destiny, and how from those words I was called and justified and glorified. Well, I think we've got a good head of steam for all these five questions. If that all is making sense, and you're beginning to see how important context is and keeping things in their proper sense and sequence, then we're good to go. If we've got any trouble or problems with it, think about it, and if we need to, we can ask those things next time. But everything makes sense up to that point? All right. Let's close. Heavenly Father, again,